Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 292nd episode of Objectively Speaking. My name is Naomi Brockwell, and I am delighted to be joining you here today on this chat and to be talking with Jennifer Grossman. This is a very special anniversary webinar today, and we'll be looking back at the past 10 years of Atlas Society, and we'll be talking about what the next 10 years has in store. So, Jag, it is so nice to have you here. Welcome.
Well, thank you. And, you know, as I was saying right before we went live, I'm so grateful to you for doing this. And I go back with you, not just to the very first Atlas Society Gala, where you were mistress of ceremonies and all of the things that you've done with us since then, as your career has skyrocketed. But even before that, even before I was offered the job years before, I was trying to get this various libertarian venture off the ground, and you were always there. So you're a true friend, and I really appreciate you.
I have been delighted to know you for such a long time and watch you as well. And I'm very excited that now I get to ask you questions about
this. I know, this is weird.
I get to share with the audience about all of the amazing things that you have done, and just watching. Oh my goodness, watching what you have done at Atlas Society has been incredible. So let's get started and let's just go back 10 years, right? That was when you first started working for Atlas Society. So how did you land at Atlas Society? How did that happen?
Well, all right. So let's see. This week, Monday, this past Monday, was my first day, March 1st, 2016. And it was interesting because, you know, I spent a long time in Washington, D.C. in a prior life. I was a researcher and then a speechwriter in the White House for President Bush 41. I was a director of education policy at the Cato Institute. But I left all that behind and I came out to Malibu, California, and I worked in the corporate world at Dole Food Company. And then after that chapter ended, I was just kind of doing various things. And a really close friend of mine, another girlfriend, the girls mafia here, reached out and said, you know, I heard about this opening. She knew David Kelly and knew that they were looking to hire a new CEO. And she said, you know, there's this crazy Ayn Rand obsessed lady living on a cliff in Malibu, and maybe you should talk to her. And that was kind of the beginning of it. A little funny side note to that was I was kind of down in the dumps at the time because a guy that I was seeing had been had broken up with me because of an article that I wrote called Date the Atlas, Not the Shrugged. And it was kind of looking at sort of old-fashioned approach to dating and combining it with kind of principles of objectivism. And he thought, oh, you're manipulating me, broke up with me, broke my heart. But it was that article that then David Kelly saw and said, wow, okay, she's a good writer and she knows a little bit of something and she doesn't take herself too seriously. So it all worked out in the end.
Oh my gosh, I want to read that article. Can you send that to me?
It's on the website. Maybe our gremlins can drop it into the chat. It's called Date the Atlas, Not the Shrug.
I want to read that. And also his loss. I mean, goodness, he doesn't know what he gave up. That, what an idiot. Good riddance to that person. So let's talk. I mean, I would love to know, like, after David Kelly reached out to you, how did the interview process go? What was that like?
Well, it was a little eye-opening, okay, because I have had White House positions, I have had State Department positions, I have been researched for top secret security clearances, and I'll say I never got a more thorough vetting than I had at the Atlas Society with these trustees, and I was like, whoa, these guys take this like really, really seriously, and they did background checks and they, I think I had, at least one kind of, you know, conference call interview and then two in-person interviews with the entire, board of trustees. And I do remember at one point, you know, they're like, okay, you know, you check this box off, check that box off. But and yeah, we get that you've, you know, read everything that Ayn Rand has ever written, but we don't really know if you're like steeped in objectivism enough, if you're enough of an objectivist. And I said, you know, guys, if that is what your criteria is for finding an executive who can help turn this organization around and grow revenues and, you know, organize staff and, you know, have a plan for growth, I'm not sure I want this job because, yes, obviously I need to understand objectivism, but in terms of people having, you know, deep philosophical conversations, I hire those people. We have a faculty of Atlas Society scholars who are professors, and they are the true experts on objectivism.
I love that. And I love that this doesn't, you know, disappear into dogma. This is about like interesting conversations and exploring ideas. And in particular, what Atlas Society has done an amazing job at is getting people to talk about things that seem to be so taboo in society, you know? And I love that, that exploration of ideas, that it's okay to discuss things. And you do so much discussion. I love that. So we are getting some questions coming through in the chat, which is great. Thank you to everyone who is watching. It is lovely to see you there. So I might just throw to one of these questions first, and then I want to circle back and talk about some of the other things you're doing in the early days. But I have a question here from My Modern Gold, who says, what books besides those of Rand have shaped your thinking the most during your time as CEO? Are there any of those books that you picked up for these live streams? I'm not sure about the second part, what they mean about are there any books you picked up for the live streams, but are there any other books that have shaped your thinking the most?
Yeah, I would definitely say Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl is a book that I've returned to many times. I think that gratitude is a theme that's important for us here at the Atlas Society. And I always say that in order to be objective, you need to have perspective. And reading about somebody who maintained a relatively positive mindset and chose his attitude, even while living in a concentration camp, really helps whatever, you know, you're going through, whether it's a tragedy or your house burns down or you lose your job or you lose an important relationship. Just remembering to put it into context and think about gratitude, not just as a, you know, Hallmark card slogan, but as a way of, again, making sure that you're being objective. We always have a tendency, right, from evolutionary biology to look out for problems, to look out for threats. But then that can maybe exaggerate them in terms of their actual importance. And we tend to discount all of the things that we've got going for us. And we need to take stock of those as well, because that gives us ballast to continue and to persevere. So, wow, in terms of the books for this podcast, there's been so many I'll have to actually come up with the list. Thanks for that idea. I'm going to come up with my 10 years, 10 best books that authors we've had on Objectively Speaking.
Selfishly, I cannot wait for that list, and I'm going to work my way through them. I have read the Viktor Frankl book and I absolutely adored it as well. So that would be another recommendation for me also. I want to go to a question, like it's a personal question. I would love to know how you discovered Ayn Rand in the first place.
Well, as with so many of my stories, it's a little embarrassing because I didn't discover her until actually relatively later in life. I grew up in Newton, Massachusetts. I never met a Republican or a conservative or an objectivist or a libertarian, went to Harvard, never even heard of the books, although it was interesting to later learn that my parents had read both The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. I was at the Cato Institute, and a colleague of mine there, Jose Pinheiro, we were working on some pension reform policy. And I think that I heard somebody say, "Who is John Galt?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, who is John Galt?" And first they laughed and thought I was joking. And then they realized I really didn't, at least he did. He pulled me aside. He said, "Grossman, I don't know how you got in here," and gave me the book. And I read it, you know, I was one of those people that, you know, read it in a few days, just kind of, you know, cover to cover. And then went on to read everything else. And it resonated with me on so many different levels. And one personal one was that I had these experiences with envy. Yeah, you know, when I was in the third grade, when I was in the fourth grade, and actually my Draw My Life video, which was like the beta, the like test version that we did before we started cranking those out at scale, recounts how I was being bullied, not for like a lisp or a disability or what have you, but for my strengths and how I early on tried to appease these girls that were doing this. And I said, "What can I do to make you stop?" And they said, "Well, you can kill yourself." And I said, "Well, that's not going to happen." And then I realized that, you know, envy is, well, I'm not sure if I realized then, but I started to have enter my consciousness this idea that envy is irrational and that it is an unappeasable hatred. And then, you know, finding Al Shrugged and the Fountainhead and the Virtue of Selfishness gave me a much better understanding of that. And I, you know, truly believe that it's not just a lack of proper education that is driving the popularity of socialism. It really is an epidemic of bad values. And I believe that Ayn Rand's literature can really inoculate young minds against these mind viruses of envy, resentment, and victimhood and entitlement. And now we have the challenge, of course, young people, used to read in my day, 70%, we were, you know, reading fiction every day for fun. That's probably around 10% today. So that is reality. A is A. You can't turn away from it in some kind of guilty, foggy hope that it doesn't matter, but you have to find other ways to engage young people with these ideas. And that involves going on a sociological experiment of really studying what kinds of content they are consuming and engaging with and where, and then finding ways to bring these ideas into that kind of content. And so far it's working pretty well.
I just finished reading We the Living again. The last time I read it was maybe 15 years ago. And gosh, it's like a gut punch. When you're talking about how society, we really need to shift culture and it's just bad values. Gosh, just reading an entire book of just a society built on those bad values. It was so heartbreaking. She's such a powerful writer. Candice Morena says, "Envy is evil." So I thought I would just interject that. So we've got another question in the group here. When you were talking about hiring and the questions David Kelly gave to you and your response and saying, you know, would you rather have someone who can hire these people and lead them and all of that? So Richard Salzman asks, is it more difficult to recruit staff or intellectuals and why?
Well, it depends on the role. I think that it's challenging to recruit intellectuals in part because we have a very different, very unique brand of objectivism, of open objectivism. We agree with Ayn Rand when she said a few years before her death that she has a complete philosophical system, but the job of elaborating a system is one that no philosopher can complete in his lifetime. There's still a lot of work to be done. So there's that, but there's also really the kind of spirit that we bring to our work, which is non-dogmatic and being entrepreneurial and benevolent and being on the lookout for people that we might be able to work with in some ways and not being afraid to talk to groups where, you know, we might have even some serious disagreements on some very fundamental issues. So, you know, I think that I've been disappointed to see how persistent this, I almost call it the narcissism of small differences that those who have a different view of objectivism wouldn't want to work with us. And, I've tried many, many times to invite certain other objectivist thought leaders to come on this show. And it's like, that, can't sanction your fraudulent activities or what have you. I think it's also challenging because, there's not a lot of objectivism within academia. And so one of the components of the 10-year strategic plan that I have is a program of advanced intellectual engagement that would be geared towards refreshing the pipeline of scholarly academic talent. Mm.
So there are a couple of questions that I want to roll into one, and it's on the point of during your process running Atlas Society, talking about your biggest challenges, biggest opportunities. So a couple of questions which are in that vein that I want to bring up, which may influence your answers. So Richard Salzman says, Rand's books are fabulous but lengthy. How do you meet the challenge of youth reading less in recent years or less deeply? So that's on the challenges side, maybe one challenge to think about. And on the success side, we have Robert Begley, who'd like to know what has been the biggest breakthrough in reaching a new generation of independent thinkers. So some of the challenges, some of the successes that you've had.
Well, one way to do it, that while, reading of fiction among our key demographic is gone, way down, unfortunately, there's another category which actually has defied that trend and actually increased, and that's graphic novels. If you go into any high school library or any public library, you'll see kind of wall-to-wall graphic novels. So early on, I agreed with Ayn Rand that art is the indispensable medium for the communication of a moral ideal. And we decided to lean into graphic novels. And again, not just, hiring any graphic artist or illustrator, but finding one who already has a well-established following. And so we were able to do that with Dan Parsons, and we did our graphic novel of Anthem and followed that up with Red Pawn, and then took notes for a screenplay Ayn Rand was working on about the development of the atom bomb and how that could only happen in a country where free minds are able to operate freely. That's our third. Now we are I would say close to finishing up our graphic novel of The Fountainhead. Of course, that won't be able to be published for many years, but it certainly has been very exciting on my end. And then, I think one of the things that everybody always runs up against is people don't think about distribution, right? So they're like, oh, we've got these great courses. Oh, we've got this great video. Oh, we've got this great publication. Well, where are you going to distribute it? And so that's when we happened upon this novel distribution strategy of leveraging these Comic-Cons, which are a cultural phenomenon that happens coast to coast, bringing Dan Parsons to there, sponsoring them. And that's become one of the biggest avenues of people getting introduced to Ayn Rand, not knowing who Ayn Rand was, not knowing how to pronounce Ayn Rand. So that has been one of the ways. Then another way that we did it was from day one, I wanted to do a video book trailer of Atlas Shrugged. Some of you may be familiar with the book trailers that best-selling authors like Jack Carr, or Greg Hurwitz do when they have a new release, but Ayn Rand really never had a book trailer. So it took a long time, but in the past couple of years, we were able to create an AI model to turn live action into anime. And we did a book trailer of Atlas Shrugged. It got 12 million views and it doubled sales of the novel within the ensuing months. And then we followed that up with The Fountainhead and with several similar treatments of Anthem. And happy to say that not only are these moving the needle in terms of book sales, but they've also allowed us to attract funding for a full-length feature film of Anthem. And I think this is very important because, again, going back to the role of art and how powerful it is, not just with its potential to shift individual consciousness, but to shift the values of a culture. And in Ayn Rand's day, a novel had the ability, a blockbuster novel had the ability to have that kind of mass impact. Today, I'm afraid that only film has that potential. So I'm really excited to get that underway.
That's incredible. And I mean, I'm constantly in awe of you because you're this amazing mix of someone who understands the issue and has the strength to actually pursue a difficult mission, but you're very strategic. You're actually finding clever ways to get there. And I love going to Comic-Con of all places to distribute this. Most people would be like, go to the liberty-focused conferences or, something else. And you were like, no, let's go completely out of the box. These are ideas that anyone could resonate with if you, put them in the right format. And so you put it in a format that these people really resonated with, this comic book format at Comic-Con. And I just love how you're moving the needle. It's incredible. Now, you were talking earlier about how you have this nuanced or very specific brand of objectivism that Atlas Society embraces. So on that note, I have a question here. Where is it? So Lock, Stock and Barrel asks, what has surprised you the most about the response to your viewpoint on objectivist ideas over the past decade?
Well, I think one of the things that surprised me, I hadn't quite been prepared for the tribalism. We talked about strategy, but for me, part of strategy is constant experimentation and risk-taking. And you can only do that if you have a certain amount of self-esteem, confidence that you can fall flat on your face and learn something from it and continue. And to me, that is something that this open objectivist attitude gives you. Because if you're subscribing to a more dogmatic approach, you're really constantly afraid of making a mistake or being judged or what have you. And that means that you're going to be paralyzed in terms of making moves. All progress comes from risk-taking and creativity. And I feel that that this approach to objectivism allows us to be more creative and allows us to take more risks and fall on my face many, many times. And so, again, one of my friends said, the very first video that we did at the Atlas Society, after the beta one that was about me, was, again, I saw that Draw My Life videos were very popular among young people. And they were being done by, celebrities like Jenna Marbles, kind of on a whiteboard, stick figures. I was born here. This was my mom. This was my dad. And that gets speed ramped with a narration. So I said, well, we should do a Draw My Life of Ayn Rand. But, we had two pennies to rub together. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to have to write it and I'm going to have to draw the storyboards and I'm going to have to do the narration. And I'm going to have to do the art. And so, but I thought like, well, I don't sound anything like Ayn Rand. So a neighbor of mine is a very famous speech coach to Hollywood actors with a specialty in accents. He works with Hugh Jackman and all of these people on having different kinds of accents for their role. So I trained with him to get a Russian accent. And I used that in that video. And because the video is going to be seeing part of me, I put a wig on and, I had a dress and dollar sign and all of that. And so another mentor of mine, Jim Pinkerton, said, you should take that on the road, do a Chautauqua. And it was, of course, very terrifying to do that because, again, I was at the beginning. I think I actually would be more comfortable doing it now because I was still learning, right? I was really still learning and was even more of a novice student of objectivism in those days. But I remember doing an early one with Jeffrey Tucker, And he was in white tails and I was dressed up as Ayn Rand, and we were going through. And I just remember somebody saw that early video and they're like, that was the most horrible, horrific, terrible, frightening thing I've ever seen. And I'm like, God, like, have you been under a rock? I mean, like people getting their head choppers are, you know, busy in the Middle East. And this is like the most horrible thing that you've seen. But anyway, it was just a little bit, that was eye-opening. But again, you know, I think that what objectivism gives you is you're like, so, you know, what? I don't care. You don't have a lot of people, you don't care a lot about what people think of you if you don't actually respect them that much in the first place.
Yeah, hate is going to hate. So, but on that, I mean, you mentioned that sometimes falling flat on your face. I don't believe that for a second, actually.
Oh, yeah.
But I would be very curious to learn what were some of your earliest successes and earliest failures, because I'm sure there are lots of budding CEOs out there who want to learn from experiences. So I would be very interested if you have some stories to share.
Sure. Well, let's start with the failures and get them out of the way. I think I wouldn't count that one as a failure, actually. Did we go a bit off the air? Oh, there we are. I'm back.
There we are. We're back.
Okay. I thought, again, I wanted to take this in an artistic direction. I thought that this was a space that nobody else was really owning in the Liberty world. And so, but I think I took it a little bit too literally at the beginning. And I wasn't thinking, you know, I wanted to have an art contest, right? I wanted to have artists submit works that would somehow, you know, express a sense of life, you know, a kind of Ayn Rand sense of life. And we really struggled to get entries. And again, it was probably too early to do something like this. I mean, you know, we didn't even have much of a platform to promote a contest. I mean, I remember when I first started, our entire social media digital audience was 40,000. And today it's almost 3.3 million. I mean, wow. This is like a 20,000% increase.
That's so incredible.
You know, if we were to do something like that today, I'm sure we would get more takers. So I think sometimes being a little bit too literal. I also made many, you know, bad hires, and it really did take a while to get to the team that we have now. And I really feel that we've got an A team and people who work together very well. And I just want to make sure that we keep them on board. We keep providing them value and provide them a path for growth and long-term stability.
Yeah, that's incredible. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, you could have a noble mission and you could even have a good pathway for getting there, but ultimately it's about the team. You know, is it a good leader? Is there a good group that is, you know, all participating in this? And I think you've identified some amazing people. I'm just judging from the results that you're getting. So whatever you're doing, you seem to have some sort of a secret recipe there. So huge congratulations for the tremendous success that you've been having. So we've got some more questions in the chat here. And one of them is from Valiant Mike. Valiant Mike asks, which Atlas Society project of the last 10 years excited you the most? Valiant Mike's favorite was the animated book trailers. You already talked about, you know, a bunch of them, but do you have a favorite out of any of these projects that you've launched?
Well, Valiant Mike, I'm probably with you there. This was a kind of a minor project, but along those same lines, again, strategically, seeing that so many searches now take place, you know, not on some, you know, Google or what have you, but they're actually taking place on YouTube. So I wanted to find out what were the top Ayn Rand and objectivist related searches and what videos were they pointing to. And I saw that, you know, it was all over the place, and that it was, one was going to Reason and one was going to, you know, Stossel and what have you. So we created search videos. Well, basically videos to cater to those top searches. So who is Ayn Rand? Who is John Galt? How to pronounce Ayn Rand? What is objectivism? Why is Ayn Rand so controversial? And then, you know, because of the quality and also because of the latency, that those now have the top spot on all of those searches. And that's really led to a noticeable bump in the quality of subscribers that we have on the YouTube channel. I'd also say that something I'm really the most excited about was what was the merger that took place early last year, in January of last year. I had my eye on this group called the Ayn Rand Center Europe for many, many years. I was a great admirer of their leadership and also of their model. Again, lots of people have online courses, but this group had the statistics to and the KPIs to show that that people were, it wasn't just courses out there. People were taking the courses, doing the homework, passing the exams, writing the essays, and then bringing it all together at a conference, a European conference that they had for alumni. Well, they approached me, asked if I might be able to raise the money to acquire them, to essentially effect a merger. And I was able to raise quite a good chunk, not quite the former budget that they had, but again, with any merger, you've got some synergies. And so we've made it work. And again, I've been working on this 10-year strategic plan, and I believe that this is the area where we have the biggest opportunity to scale. Right now, well, last year we had 20 John Galt schools. These are 8-week courses, introductory courses on objectivism for about 20 or 25 in each cohort. And these are pretty rigorously selected. Sometimes we'll get 100, 150 applications for any John Galt school. So these are really the best of the best. I would like to scale. So 20 schools last year, 22 schools this year. I'd like to scale the number of John Galt schools to 100 by 2036. Currently we have a European conference in addition to our Galt's Gulch U.S. conference. I plan to, again, not only increase the size of the European conference, but start to introduce regional conferences in Africa and Latin America and Asia, because the demand for objectivism and for a new kind of lens to understand oneself, one's place in the world, and the world around us is just really rocketing in places like the Middle East, Africa, India. So I'm very excited about that.
I feel like I could take a masterclass from you. If you ever start offering classes in leadership and being a CEO, like I'm the first person to sign up, because I love listening to your strategies here. We have another question from Lock, Stock and Barrel asking, has anything changed in how you understand leadership since you first stepped into the CEO role? And I'm very interested in that too.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say much has changed. I think I've become more comfortable with imperfection. You know, I think if I look at some of my previous, op-eds in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, I have them all here on the roll. I mean, God, I would just agonize over things like that. But I think this heavy emphasis on reaching young people online and just the more ephemeral nature of social media has just been like, it does the job. Okay. It doesn't have to be perfect. I don't need, 12 takes to answer this Instagram question. But then also just continuing to learn to delegate more and to find other people to take on best use roles, right? Again, like my doing everything in that first video, right? And so, how do I continue to delegate, continue to groom personnel and others to take on these roles so I can, because in that 10-year plan, okay, so when I took over, we had less than $1 million in revenues. We closed out 2025 with over $4 million in revenues. I'm aiming for $5 million this year, and I'm aiming for $10 million by 2036. I believe it is eminently doable, but yeah, that's going to be a lot more traveling for me. And so, finding somebody to eventually take over Objectively Speaking and take over more of our video content is part of the plan.
Yeah, I've got a fun comment here from Chuckle. Cuffy Megs was a real jerk. Just thought I would share that with you all. I think we all agree. So we've got a question here from Andrew. Andrew Esquivel. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Andrew asks, what is your elevator pitch for why someone should explore objectivism?
I would say that if you want a world of more liberty, you don't have to be an objectivist to understand Ayn Rand's historic role as the all-time greatest recruiter for the liberty movement. Young people are not reading anymore today. And so we have to meet them where we are. The Atlas Society is doing that. We have a larger digital audience than, certainly all other objectivist groups combined, but as well as many libertarian groups. And we are finding young people, meeting them where they are, and then creating content for skimmers, swimmers, and deep divers, and upselling them opportunities for deeper engagement. So.
And we've got a question. You were talking before about your merger. And so I think this relates to that somewhat. My Modern Gold asks, is the international audience more receptive versus people in the US? I am very curious about that also.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is because like the US has, it's so funny. I have a fun anecdote. When I first moved to the US, I took Russian lessons for a few years. And in my Russian class, you know how you always have to do like small talk, like my name is Naomi. I have two sisters, you know, you learn all of these things. So we start talking about, okay, what's my favorite book and all of this stuff. So I'm like, oh, Atlas Shrugged. And the room basically gasps. And they're like, oh, she said Atlas Shrugged. And I was like, what? Have you heard of it? Like no one in Australia had heard of it. You know, I kind of felt like I had discovered this amazing gold nugget and no one knew what I was talking about. So when I said it, I didn't expect anyone to know of it. And instead, everyone knew about it. No one had read it, but they all had opinions on it. And mm-hmm. I found that so fascinating. So I would love your take about that difference culturally.
Yeah, well, you're not alone in having that kind of experience. Chip Wilson, who's the founder of Lululemon, was one of our honorees at an earlier gala, had a similar experience. You know, he was so inspired by Atlas Shrugged that he used Dagny as a model for his Lululemon woman, right? A modern woman who's looking for comfortable athletic clothing that she can work out in, but also just live her life in. And so at his Lululemon's tours, he had the famous Lululemon bag, and he printed on one, "Who is John Galt?" He's from Canada, okay? He didn't realize that this is like this radioactive, toxic thing. And, he basically sparked a revolt at his own company and a backlash against him from U.S. U.S. consumers and customers. So, it's partially that America is very polarized, and I think that the left recognizes that Ayn Rand has been again the most effective all-time recruiter for the liberty movement, and in particular, her moral defense of capitalism and her not being willing to accede, oh, their motivations are okay. Saying, no, actually their motivations aren't okay. They're not, inspired by compassion. They're inspired by envy and by hatred of the good and by entitlement and by greed, properly understood as the desire for the unearned. So, I think that that is why she has been so demonized here in the United States. It's a tribute to her effectiveness. And that's just simply not a factor overseas. So I, just instinctively push where I can see, that there's a lot of give and there's a lot of opportunity to grow. And we did that in Venezuela. We had after the early protests against Maduro, we had a video about Venezuela. We pushed it into Venezuela with a few hundred bucks. It went viral. I raised 30,000. I put it back into Venezuela. We ended up with 230,000 Venezuelan subscribers from within Venezuela. And then we kept on feeding them more Spanish content and more Ayn Rand content and more objectivist content. And that number of Venezuelans within Venezuela grew to 400,000. That kind of makes a difference, I believe. You know, we have the whole operation, or we had it teed up to do the same thing in Iran. The Iranian part of it, using VPN destinations to get this English language asset into Iran, has been stymied for the moment because of what's happening. But we also wanted to disrupt Iranian propaganda in the Middle East. And so we did an Arabic asset and put it into Arabic-speaking countries. And again, it's over, 250,000 YouTube subscribers from the Middle East. I think there's just a lot of people around the world that are tired of these old isms. In this case, Pan-Arabism, Arab nationalism, Islamism, socialism, and they're looking for a new way of understanding the world. And I think that that we really have an opportunity to make some material difference in some of these formerly and currently very, very oppressed authoritarian regions of the world.
I wish you all the best of luck there. It's so tremendously important for the people there. They need a lot of help right now. So thank you for everything that you're doing. I have a question from Chuckle before I want to get to, talking about the future, which I want to make sure that we cover in this video. But before we get there, a question from Chuckle. Chuckle wants to know, who is Dagny patterned after? I am curious about that. Do you have any insight? Like, I know that some of the other main protagonists across the novels have been patterned against, famous people of the era. Is Dagny, patterned against anyone that you know of?
Not that I know of. I know that I've interviewed Jennifer Burns and Anne Heller, two of Rand's biographers. Objectively speaking, I didn't ask that specific question, but I also didn't pick it up in those biographies, which I've read several times. I know that she talks about Dominique, who I don't like very much, don't relate to very much as Ayn Rand on a bad day.
Right.
and of course, that Kira in We the Living is the most autobiographical of her novels, but I'm not sure about that. I'll do some research.
Yeah, I'd be very, very curious. Maybe it could just be an ideal that she was painting. So I want to move on to questions about the future, and I want to know what you have in store for 2026.
Well, okay. So hopefully at some point we'll be able to continue this operation in Iran. The next big thing that we have on tap is Galt's Gulch in San Diego. We decided this year, actually, we've been doing annual galas. We've moved to every other year, so no gala this year. So while this is largely still a kind of student and young adult environment, I wanted to bring more donors in. So we're going to be doing a donor dinner cruise. You can go to the Atlas Society website, apply for a scholarship if you're 35 and under. Otherwise, buy a ticket and come and meet me there. So that is a big deal. As I mentioned, we're increasing our Galt's Gulch, our John Galt schools from 20 to 22 this year. We've got our European conference coming up in Porto in September. So I'm excited about that. We are very close. We've already signed this new talent. Her name is Maggie Anders. She was formerly with Fee. And I think she's just a tremendously bright and charismatic young woman. And we have signed her on to do long form content every other week. And it's going to include also her documenting her Ayn Rand journey, because she's read The Fountainhead, but she's going to be reading the rest of the books in Rand's oeuvre. But, just doing content that's more like, is Scandinavia socialist? not so fast, because you know we have big goals of how we're going to be growing our social media audience, including to at least 3 million YouTube subscribers this year, if not more. And so we need more content. It can't just be that. And then, of course, the big pièce de résistance, which is the production of our full-length anthem feature. And that is that's going to be exciting. We're going to be doing a lot of that work in Colombia and Latin America. And then also, this is a little bit random, but we're doing a tort reform series initiative campaign, and that's going to include, for all of you guys who know the novel, Judge Narragansett presiding over a frivolous case and walking the audience through how lawsuit abuse can lead to squelching, you know, innovation and higher costs. So that's going to be fun.
I love that. I can't wait for all of that. And I am particularly excited about the feature. That's going to be incredible. I would love to know if anyone who is watching has already bought tickets for Galt's Gulch 2026. In San Diego, I saw a preview of it when I was at the Chicago Gala this year for Atlas Society. Mm-hmm. It looks incredible. So I'm curious to see if anyone has already bought tickets there. So another question, I would love to know if you have any advice to other nonprofit leaders, people who are hoping to, you know, set their organization on a similar path of exponential growth that you have created. Because honestly, the job that you have done is incredible. The growth that I've been watching just from the you know, as a bystander, is absolutely amazing. So, you know, hats off to you. Huge congratulations. And I would just love, you know, for all the people out there who are curious for tips, what is some advice that you would give them?
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing I would look to do first is, what is the one thing that no one is doing or no one is doing well? And I remember even when I was working at Dole Food Company, all of this new technology, we're having a revolution in communication technology, and social media and video content. And I was looking at my old friends at Cato, and I was looking at other liberty groups, and I was like, why isn't anybody taking advantage of this? If you're in the business of transacting ideas, technology has now demonetized, dematerialized, and democratized how ideas are translated. So I remember urging somebody at Cato to do it. They didn't do it. And so when I came back, I'm like, still nobody's doing it, or not, you know, anybody's doing it all that well. So that very small $900,000 budget that I started with, I took a third of it and I invested it in digital media and digital content. So I would see what people aren't doing. I would also just see where there's a need. You know, I think that we have a need to bring more young women, find ways to reach more young women, right? You've got 12th grade boys trending kind of conservative, but 12th grade girls, you know, really we're losing them. And so finding ways to reach those audiences, I think is really important. And then finally, what is it that you love to do and you're going to do anyway, even if nobody's going to pay you? What are you really passionate about? And so, you know, for me, I'm passionate about artistic content. I'm passionate about Ayn Rand. I'm passionate about technological innovation. And I'm passionate about young people and repaying this debt that I feel like I owe to Ayn Rand by continuing to spread her message. So those are probably the best two pieces of advice. But then the other one would be, you better lean in to being savvy on AI while listening to Naomi and not compromising your, you know, your digital privacy. But I really think that there's going to be two kinds of nonprofits by the end of the next 5 years. And there's going to be those who have become fully fluent in and able to leverage AI to increase productivity and efficiency and output, and those who are no longer with us. And I know which one the Atlas Society is going to be in.
Yeah, so I think completely
just
agree.
With video content, like I was talking about before, I think this is another opportunity for newcomers to take advantage of that, because I think these older legacy organizations sometimes have a harder time turning the ship and being entrepreneurial. So I think this is an opportunity.
Yeah, I completely agree. And there have been some comments in the chat as well about AI. Some people saying that, you know, they're excited when it comes to animation and what we can do with that, to see some of this work that Atlas Society is putting out. Maybe we can actually use AI to turn this into full-length features or create even more content, which is really exciting. And I agree that, you know, all of this tech, it's really just another tool in our toolbox. You mentioned the privacy side for me. For me, it's about, you know, there's a spectrum of tools that you can use. And as technology grows, the answer is not to, you know, shut it out. I agree with you completely when you say that people will be left behind. It's about looking at technology and figuring out, how can I make this work for me? How do I make sure that this tech, advances me and it progresses me forward? How does it help me rather than hurt me? Some of the worries I think people have and why a lot of people hate AI is because a lot of it's used for surveillance. And I say, okay, well, you're empowered, write a better future, use it for privacy, use it for empowerment, use it to help people. The future isn't pre-written. So I love that you're encouraging people to really explore new tech. I definitely agree that it's the way forward. We probably have time for another real quick question. So just to kind of summarize here, you've talked about the milestones and things you want to achieve in 2026, and you also talked throughout our talk today about, you know, by 2036 you want this, and I'm very interested in your 10-year trajectory and like what you think the world will look like if you've succeeded in what you want to achieve with Atlas Society.
Well, so the Anthem full-length feature, to me, that's just the very beginning. And I think it's something that eventually culminates in a full-length feature film of Atlas Shrugged. But, you know, so I do see a progression of Anthem, then Anthem prequel, then Anthem sequel, and then moving on to, you know, We the Living and The Fountainhead and others as those rights become available. One way or another. And again, I think that, you know, if people are watching these are gaining a big following. I think that you really will have that gateway for people to go back and engage with reading again and really begin to internalize these values and live them. But again, I also just see a huge opportunity abroad, particularly Venezuela, Iran, Cuba. You're next. The entire Middle East, Africa. I just think that, it's one really interesting data point that stuck with me from one of the interviews that I did on this podcast was a researcher who created this social envy coefficient in which he would measure levels of envy country by country and also generation by generation, right? And he could do that with questions like, you know, how do you feel about somebody who's, you know, rich, and are they a better person or a worse person or whatever? And one of the things that he found is that in the United States, the social envy of the older generations was a lot lower than the social envy of the younger generations. Hmm. Okay. But that, again, it's another reason why I'm so excited about this international expansion. That completely flips overseas, in Europe, in other areas, that it's the older people, right, the older socialist generation, that are a lot envier, that have a lot more animus towards the successful than the younger people, who are like, oh, entrepreneur, technology, the world's changing, opportunity. So again, I think that there's an opportunity to tap into that, and you know, as we continue to move along, I think that with this explosive technological change that we're experiencing, there's going to be a lot more opportunities to engage with people from around the world. And the travel isn't going to be quite the same barrier. The technology isn't going to be quite the same barrier. The language isn't going to be quite the same barrier. And so I think that even while we're going to grow our Galt's Gulch student conference to at a minimum 500 to 1,000 students by the end of the decade, I think we have an opportunity to really have a global renaissance in objectivism over the next few years, not just the decade to come.
Gosh, I'm so excited about that. And if anyone can pull it off, it is you. So huge thank you to everything that you have done. And I'm glad that you exist. And I think that what makes you powerful is that you're just inspiring so many other people to action. You know, you yourself are an inspiration just in what you've achieved, but you're then creating new leaders in the world who are then going on to inspire others. So I just think that that network effect that you're creating is incredible. Incredible. And I can't wait to see where you are in 10 years time. Let's make sure that we meet back here. We have another one of these chats. You walk me through it all because I am so eager to watch your growth over this next decade.
Well, thank you. And I absolutely adore you. Everybody go out and check out what Naomi is doing at the Ludlow Institute. And again, most of you in the audience will know who it's named after. So a perfect name for a perfectly glamorous objectivist and very, very dear friend. So I love you, my dear.
Oh, I love you too. And thank you for having me onto this very special episode. Thank you to everyone who's been watching and tuning in, sending your questions. It's wonderful to have you guys here. So next week, make sure that you tune in because on this show, we have the author Natalie Brunel, who's going to be talking with Jag about her new book, Bitcoin is for Everyone, Why Our Financial System is Broken and Bitcoin is the Solution. So I really hope that you will all be there for that. And thank you so much for tuning in today. It's been just a wonderful conversation. We'll see you all next week.